Welcome back to Success Made to Last. I'm Rich Tokini. Our very special guest on today's show is Keith Reinhard. And you probably heard Keith on our Discovering Truth series with Tim Love. So Tim has introduced me to this fine gent. And Keith is the chairman emeritus of DDB Worldwide, which ranks among the world's largest and most creative ad agencies. And they are in 96 various countries. Keith has been given so many awards and accolades for his lifetime work in the advertising field.
Grab the bucket and mop. Scrub the bottom and top. There is nothing so clean as my burger machine. With a broom and a brush, clean it up for the rush. Before you open the door, what a shine on the floor.
23 minutes, one dance.
Start all over again. Tell me, what does it mean?
At McDonald's, it's clean. You give it a drink to gain. Don't get up and get away. To McDonald's.
And Keith, we are so glad to have you on today. Welcome to Success Made to Last.
Thank you, Rick. It's an honor to be here.
Well, nice to get to talk to you, especially during this unprecedented time with the pandemic going on. And, you know, your career has been so colorful. Will you tell us a little bit more about it and fill in the gaps for us, especially on some of the highlights?
Well, it's been a long journey, obviously with lots of obstacles and detours along the way, but I'll do it as quickly as I can. I developed an interest in advertising at a very young age. I grew up in a small Swiss Mennonite village in the northeastern part of Indiana. It was called Bern because it was settled by Swiss people from Bern, Switzerland. We were very conservative in that little village. We're not allowed to watch television. My father died when I was 3 years old. My grandfather wouldn't allow any of us to watch television. So we were allowed to listen to the radio, providing he vetted the program. So I was allowed to listen to Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, and Captain Midnight, but not ever to Ellery Queen Mysteries. So, but I liked the radio programs, but I also like the jingles. And I found out later that that was advertising. I also, my widowed mother was a clerk in the tiny grocery store in the village, and the store was so small that they couldn't display the promotional materials that were sent by companies like Kraft and General Mills and Mars Candies and Campbell Soup. So she would bring the posters home for me to look at. And I was very young and probably in grade school at that time, but I was fascinated by the pictures and who writes things like, there's so much milk in a Milky Way, you can almost hear it moo. Who does that? And Betty Crocker, she was my first pinup girl, I guess. There was no art teacher in our grade school or high school. One teacher took me under her wing and got me to enter a scholastic art competition in my freshman or sophomore year, and there were 10 categories in this contest, and I decided the way to win was to go too deep in each category, and indeed I did get some recognition in that competition. A kid from Detroit moved into our town in my sophomore year in high school, and he had a driver's license, and he said, let's go to Detroit and visit my aunt and uncle one weekend. And so we did, and we saw the Red Wings play and whatever. But the most important thing was we went to see his uncle on a Saturday morning creating an ad for Cadillac cars. Oh. And I thought, oh, people get paid for doing this kind of stuff. That's amazing. So I had no possibility to go to school. the local Rotary Club had given me a $1,000 scholarship to an art school in Indianapolis, but this was during the McCarthy era, and somebody suspected there was a pinko on the staff of the school, so they shut it down. So that was my only chance to get formal education, so I never did go to college or school. I got a job as an unpaid intern at a commercial art studio in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I learned a lot from the artists there. I mean, they sort of took me under their wings and taught me how to do ad layouts, and then I left Fort Wayne and got a job at the biggest commercial art studio in the country called Kling Studios in Chicago. And once again, I learned so much from the illustrators and layout people around me. Then I had to do my 6 months of active duty in the Army, and then followed by 6 years in the reserve, of course. But I went back to Fort Wayne and got a job to start a government products department, communications department at the Magnavox company. And there we were charged with making proposals to the government for equipment for like sonobuoys for submarines and airborne radar. But I couldn't show my work to anybody because it was all classified. But I did films underwater and in Connecticut and up in the air for radar. At Magnavox, I got a chance to go into their consumer products division in the advertising department. And that caused me to be seen by a small advertising agency in Bloomington, Illinois, that put me on the State Farm Insurance account. It wasn't the national advertising account, but it was the agent promotion business. And one big agent convention, I was asked to make a presentation, and the top account guy from the national agency in Chicago was there. And my presentation was better than his, or so he thought. And he went back to Needham, Lewis, and Brorby in Chicago and said, we gotta take a look at this kid. And one Saturday morning, I took my book of art samples to the creative director of this big agency, and he looked at it and he said, we don't have an opening for a beginning art director, but we do have an opening for a beginning copywriter. And I said, I'll take it, even though I wasn't really a copywriter, but I figured, yeah. You know, I've seen words. I can make small little newspaper ads.
Sure. And,
but the my first assignment, talk about panic, do 26 radio commercials, humorous radio commercials for State Farm Insurance.
Oh boy.
I said, Radio, I'm an art director, you know, I want to do print ads or television, whatever. And I didn't know how, so I said to my copy chief, can you give me a little advice? How do you write humor? And he looked over his glasses and said, in a very dour way, he said, you go back to your typewriter and type until you laugh. When you laugh, bring me what made you laugh. And if I laugh, it's funny. If I don't laugh, you go back and type some more. And I couldn't make him laugh. But he took a summer holiday for a couple weeks. And the account guys had a deadline, and I showed them my scripts, and they smiled and some laughed. And they said, we got to take these down to Bloomington, Illinois, and show them to the client. And they laughed. And I got back to the agency, and they gave me the best broadcast producer on staff. His name was Christopher Ford, father of Harrison Ford. He took me to Hollywood. And we got some talent, and we made some commercials, and they ran, and some people laughed, and that was sort of an inflection point. After that, people started, I was sort of in demand a little bit in the agency. Can we have the kid who wrote the State Farm, those funny ads for State Farm? And then soon I was promoted to copy chief and learned how to build teams and got a taste of leadership, doing work for some of the posters I'd seen my mom brought home for Kraft and Mars and others, State Farm, of course, Anheuser-Busch. And then I got a chance to be the creative lead on the pitch for McDonald's business, First National Account. And we won that business. And to make a long story short, I got to write their first national campaign, You Deserve a Break Today, which Ad Age kindly named the best jingle of the century. And then my career sort of took off. I became creative director of the agency, then president of the Chicago agency, and then Paul Harper, who was the CEO, decided that I should succeed him as the CEO, chairman and CEO of Needham Harper Worldwide, which was a number 16th ranked agency. And that was in 1982. By 1984, I realized that we weren't going to be big enough for all our global clients. And working with some leaders of two other agencies, including Doyle Dane Burnback, DDB, which was my dream to merge with them, we created Omnicom, and which is the holding company. And my, that was the first and only ever three-way agency merger. And my job in that merger was to take the Needham agency and DDB and turn it into a merged company, which is now DDB Worldwide. So that's the story of my journey.
That's amazing. That's amazing. That, you know, bringing all those cultures together, one could say maybe your greatest career accomplishment, because those are disparate, all different. And it's almost like you were playing Henry Kissinger and bringing about detente and having all these new characters blend together. So that's extraordinary. I've got to ask you, Keith, about the McDonald's tagline and that beautiful message of "You deserve a break today." Do you recall that the moment that the light bulb went on and that message became clear to you? What was, tell us about that origin point.
Well, I do, but I have to tell you the story of what almost happened instead. Sometimes, you know, great creative is an accident. Sometimes it's an act of inspiration. Sometimes it's an act of desperation. And this was an act of desperation. We had research that said, housewives, as they were called in that day, wanted to escape from the kitchen from time to time, meal planning. Dads wanted to escape from the high cost of taking the family out to dinner. And kids wanted to escape from broccoli and table manners once in a while. And so what do you think of when you think of an escape? We thought of islands. Those little red and white McDonald's stores spotted around the city were like islands. And so our campaign was, come to the McDonald's islands and you can escape from all these things. And McDonald's loved it. And so we were in Hollywood the second day of shooting, and we got a call from McDonald's legal that said, you can't use that because there's a chain of root beer stands. I can't remember if it was in Nebraska or Wyoming or someplace that called their outlets islands of pleasure. And so you can't, your campaign is dead. So now we got, some film in the can. I called two top music producers in New York and said, we got a problem here. They said, well, do you have a line? I said, well, not exactly. It was like, get away to McDonald's. And we started writing lyrics and, came up with, a tune, a Broadway sort of show tune. And at the end, we sang, we're so near yet far away. So get up and get away, because we're near geographically, but far away psychologically. Mm-hmm. And McDonald's loved the spirit. Wow, that's terrific. What did they say at the end? Well, they say, we're so near yet far away. I said, well, we don't like that. So now we have sold a campaign if we can find new words for seven notes. So we got ba-da-da-da-da-da-da. And we go back into the research, and some of the women used the word break from time to time in their discussion of, and so where does break go on these seven notes? And yes, I remember typing finally, you deserve a break today, so get up and get away. And I called the music writer and I said, well, I think I've got it. And we put it together, and that was the birth of You Deserve a Break Today. And we eventually dropped the last part, so get up and get away. And so that's how that was born.
Beautiful. I love that story. That's a nice bridge into talking about your favorite mentors in life. And there must have been some great characters in there that taught you how to tell a story and influenced you, Keith, to become the best version of you. Share a few stories about your favorite mentors.
Well, I think, you know, as you know, there are indirect mentors and direct mentors. And One of the things that has been so important to me is passion. And so Picasso's genius was fueled by passion. And he flouted all conventions and criticisms. He broke all the rules of the day. And that inspired me. And Martha Graham, the American modern dance dancer, modern dance and choreographer, she's been compared to Picasso's influence on art. And she said, great dancers are not because of their technique. They're not great because of that. They're great because of their passion. So those and others influenced me about the importance of passion. And passion, of course, is expressed in three different ways, I think, or I've found. Curiosity, enthusiasm, and persistence. And Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, who I did know, taught me the importance of persistence and perseverance. He was 55 years old before he actually founded McDonald's, so he was persistent for all those years selling shake machines. And he loved a quote and sometimes took credit for this quote, although it was really Calvin Coolidge who said this, a great statement on the importance of persistence. And I have it here in front of me. It says, nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. And Coolidge went on to say the slogan, press on, has solved and always will solve the problems of the human race. Persistence. And that was very important to me. And I think that's, press on is a good statement for today to solve problems of today. Lao Tzu, I did not know Lao Tzu. He was 500 BC Chinese philosopher. But his statement about leadership was so important to me always. Sort of the idea of servant leadership. And he said, the greatest leaders, when the task is finished, are barely visible. When the task is successfully completed, the people will remark, we did it ourselves. And that to me was category 5 leadership. And I always kept that in mind as I learned some of the lessons of leadership. In terms of direct mentors, I mean, going back to Bern, Indiana, there was a cabinet maker across the alley from my widowed mother's home. And he had resigned from Dunbar Furniture, which was a high-end manufacturer in my hometown. They made expensive furniture for cruise ships and Hollywood stars. And Willie decided that their quality was not good enough for him, so he quit and started his own cabinet shop. And he wouldn't let anybody in except my brother and me because he knew we were the widow's kids. And we could go over and watch Willie as he sanded and filed. And then as we left, each time in his Swiss accent, he would say, boys, be always good. Be always good stayed with me as a sort of a life theme. Be good to others. Be good to yourself. Be good to God. Be always good. He was an early mentor. My grandfather, who sort of took over from my father, he was great. He was a great real estate person, but also he conducted farm sales. He was an auctioneer. And he taught me the importance of selling and how to sell, and that showmanship is a part of salesmanship. But I loved how he converted a Chevy owner into buying a Ford, the importance of understanding your consumer. And he listened to this farmer's Chevy rattling down Main Street one day. And he waited until it was a rainy day. He was working for the Ford agency. And he waited for a rainy day. Then he takes a brand new Ford out to this farmer's house, knocks on the door and says, Ed, it's raining today. It's too wet to plow. I heard some rattles in that Chevy of yours going down Main Street, and I brought a brand new Ford for you to try out on the two lane. And he converted the guy from Chevy to Ford, and he became a lasting customer. And the other thing, in his farm sales, as he was, you know, trying to raise the bid, he would tell jokes or he would quote from scripture. if the billing wasn't going high enough on the farm, he'd say, "I'm going to quote now from Isaiah." And he'd read the chapter and verse that says, "Come now and let us reason together." And he said, "I didn't say that. The Lord said that." So he was a great mentor. And then later on, Stanley Marcus, who was the merchandising genius of the Neiman Marcus store, and I got to know him pretty well. I was reading his book called Quest for the Best, and I found myself underlining and highlighting so many passages that I decided to send the book to Stanley Marcus, who I did not know, and say, "Dear Mr. Marcus, I wonder if an author ever wonders what's important to a reader. And so I've sent you my book. Please send it back, because otherwise I have to buy a book again and go through the highlighting process." And he called me back. We became friends. He became a mentor to me. He taught me about the importance of having a point of view as a person, as a company. Neiman Marcus' point of view on chocolate was, it comes from Belgium. It's dark. If you want milk chocolate, you have to go somewhere else. And then the wonderful story about Christmas, a week before Christmas, they closed their store and invited men, closed the store to women, invited men to come in, and their sales staff would help them find a perfect gift, Christmas gift, for their wife, mother, daughter, sister, whatever. And so they give the customers a glass of champagne. Stanley sees a guy sitting there with his head in his hands, walks up to him and says, "Sir, what would your wife like for Christmas?" And the guy says, "I don't know. That's why I'm here." He said, "Have another glass of champagne, but tell me about your wife. What colors does she like? What does she like to do? How does she like to dress? And tell me about her." And he listened. The importance of listening. How important is that? And so he goes back to the warehouse. He remembered a brandy snifter, big, huge brandy snifter that they had used in a window display. He goes to the cashmere sweater counter. And now he knows the color to choose because he knows what the wife likes. He picks cashmere sweaters and makes a pousse café in this brandy snifter. And then he gets a piece of white angora to sort of put a top, goes to the jewelry counter and puts a red ruby on top, comes back and presents it to the guy and said, "This, sir, is what your wife would like for Christmas." And of course, he made a customer. And that was a great lesson. Once you create a customer, you don't have to worry about making a sale. So those were some of my mentor stories.
Beautiful, beautiful. Hey, Keith, I'm going to skip over your State of the Union address and leap to this concept of brands made to last. And what you were just mentioning with Stanley Marcus and others may be the biggest challenge for some of the chief marketing officers that listen to this show. And so the question is, how in the world can they build their brands and strive to have this same kind of trust and delivery of promise for the long haul so they can have the so-called brands that are made to last for the future?
Yeah, good question, Rick. I thinking about this, I thought maybe the biggest challenge might actually be to keep advertising during these times. Although the inclination to cut advertising is already being manifest, there are some very good reasons that advertising during a downturn makes a lot of sense. For example, while the noise level in your brand category goes down because competitors are cutting back their advertising, this is a great opportunity to stand out and build awareness, trust, and loyalty in your brand, all at lower ad rates. So even if you don't have lots to sell at the moment, you can create goodwill for your brand that will pay off when the market picks up. I remember my own experience. There was a time when State Farm did not want to sell any more car insurance for reasons, the market reasons. They really didn't have capacity. But they chose to go on radio at that time, NBC's Monitor weekend radio program hosted by Dave Garraway. And they for 3 years, we wrote commercials using, you know, high profile people, Dave Garraway, Al Capp, Don Adams, Sir David Frost, whatever, just to talk about State Farm's service and their beliefs. And so this is a good opportunity for brands to keep advertising. There's some other examples from the past that maybe the best of the classics might be the in the dry cereal category. In the 1920s, Post was the category leader in the ready-to-eat cereal category. But during the Depression, they just cut back almost totally on their advertising budget. So Kellogg's doubled its advertising spend, invested heavily in radio, and introduced a new cereal called Rice Krispies, featuring Snap, Crackle, and Pop. And so Kellogg's profits grew, I don't know, by 25-30% or more, and the company became the category leader, a position that's maintained for decades. And they found that, they saw that opportunity to take advantage of lower rates and the absence of competitors. But I was thinking about this. I thought of what Sam Walton said when founder of Walmart, when somebody said, what do you think about a recession? And he said, I thought about it and decided not to participate. but your question about trust is interesting. One of the reasons marketers need brands is that that's how you build trust with brands. I remember once when we told a focus group of women that the Morton Salt actually packed the house brand, which sold for pennies less than Morton. And they all said, no, but we trust the little girl in the umbrella, and when it rains, it pours. That's what a brand can do. But these days, a skeptical public has really lost trust in so many, well, in everything, you know that. Including business, but I mentioned once before to you something called the Edelman Trust Barometer. It measures the types of organizations based on two criteria, their competence and their ethics. And government has minus numbers on both dimensions. NGOs have plus scores on ethics, but minus numbers on competence. And business scores positive on competence, but very negative on ethics. And so I would agree with people who say the best way business can build trust is to is to not only talk about how good they are, but to pay fair wages, offer better benefits, create more jobs. And the best way they can erode trust is to pay off government officials, you know, outsized compensation to their senior management and find ways to avoid paying taxes. But as you know, more and more advertisers are now aligning with a purpose. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a good time for advertisers to do that, to say, okay, this is what we stand for. You know what we sell and what we will sell when everything is back to some version of normal. But here's what we stand for. And not only for consumers, but employees as well. In that same trust barometer survey, 92% of employees said it's really important that my CEO speak out on one or more of these issues: training for jobs of the future, ethical use of tech, automation's impact on jobs, income inequality, diversity, climate change, or immigration. So, but it's important that if you align with a cause or a purpose, you actually do it. I mean, brands like Warby Parker are a good example of how to do it. You know, their positioning is that you should be able to look good and see well without paying a ton of money for a pair of glasses. And by the way, for every pair you buy, we're going to donate a pair of glasses to one of these organizations helping people around the world to see. So, so keep advertising, find a purpose, make sure you really do that or you're really in trouble. Nike, did a wonderful video about equality, and it tested poorly in a test that was run in London because people found work practices in Asia that were not living up to their statement about equality. So you have to really be doing what you're proposing as your purpose.
There you go. Yeah, you just answered several of our other questions because you answered the question about the future of advertising because it's not the secret isn't great storytelling, it's story doing. And in doing that, you build your trust and you deliver a promise. So it's fantastic. All right, Keith, so we're going to wrap up today's show with one of our signature questions. And it really originates from one of our favorite books called Who's in Your Room. And when you read this book, it talks about this metaphorical room that we let all these people into and over the course of our life, and you're playing the doorman and all these people are able to walk into your room and there's some anchors in there and there's some engines that actually drive you. And one of the key questions of this book says, what am I doing when I feel most alive? And from that, we built this question of when you look back on your life, what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self in terms of who you let into your room years ago and what positive influence they've had on your best version? So what advice are you going to give to your 20-year-old self today?
That's really an interesting question. I think the advice I would give to my 20-year-old self is embrace the importance of networking. I grew up in a very conservative community, and it was like you keep your nose to the grindstone, you do what you do, and don't worry about other people. And it was later in my career that I finally discovered the importance of networking, the importance of and the truth of the saying, no man is an island. That's a cliche for a reason. And why so many individuals have actually succeeded in their career because they've had a strong network or networking channels that they've created over the years and have helped them in their exchange of ideas, discovery of newer opportunities, even making themselves feel better in terms of self-confidence and sometimes growing long-lasting relationships. So that would be my advice. I didn't know that. I didn't believe it until later in my career, and I would have been better off had I learned that early on.
Excellent. Well, Keith, thank you so much for being on Success Made to Last. I've been taking copious notes during this show, and one of the key words is that you listen to people really carefully and you listen to your clients, and at the heart of you is just practicing greatness when it comes to listening. So isn't that a wonderful takeaway for our listening audience? Just try to practice that skill today. And I really appreciate you being on. It was just a joy to hear you, especially talking about your favorite mentors.
Thank you very much, Nick. Rick, it's really really a pleasure to be with you, Rick, and I'm honored that you asked me to be on.
You bet. And will you come back and talk to us again? How about an annual meeting, not like a physical with a doctor, but how about coming back to Success Made Last every year and catching us up on everything going on in your life and giving us your State of the Union address in your own fashion, especially with takeaways like it's about story doing versus storytelling. We'd really love that.
Well, I have a lot to say about storytelling and story doing. And as for your invitation, I'll remember Arthur Godfrey sign off, be the good Lord willing.
I love that. Thank you, sir. And to quote one of your mentors, be always good. So we appreciate you being on. That was Keith Reinhardt. We loved what he had to say, especially about his favorite mentors in life. What a great guy. We appreciate him being on our Success Made to Last show. Hey, our sponsors today are Gracefully Yours greeting cards. You can go to gracefully-yours.com to buy your favorite birthday and encouragement cards. In these unprecedented days and times, we really need encouragement for each other. So go to their website and buy some of their great encouragement cards. And then also thanks to Edward Jones and their long-term sponsorship of this program. When you need financial advice that feels more individual, you should talk to Edward Jones. And this is an incredible time for you to invest while the marketplace is settled down a bit and rocketing back forth as America comes out of the pandemic. Our guy that we talked to there is Serban Maracini. You can reach Serban at Serban.Maracine at edwardjones.com. Hey, thanks for joining us on our program. As we always say, may you live the best version of you. Have a great week. Hey, and thanks to our sponsor, Gracefully Yours greeting cards and their hilarious Church Kitchen Lady cards. Church Kitchen Ladies are a bunch of maybe 20 million volunteers across the United States that work in 300,000 churches, and they say stuff like, mind your own biscuits and life will be gravy. They also say, crunch tacos, not abs. And your crazy is showing, you might want to tuck that back in. And one of our favorites is Life is Short, Lick the Bowl. If you want to find out more about the wonderful Church Kitchen Ladies and join their roundtable, go to gracefully-yours.com today and find out about Church Kitchen Ladies and purchase all the rest of the fine Gracefully Yours greeting cards.